Have you ever heard a musical artist described as having great chops? What does that mean? Well, the term chops is slang in the music business that refers to an artist that has developed great skills over time, whether they are a musician, composer, producer, or other titles associated with the music business. This is Scott Grimaldi, your host of Got Chops. Join me as I interview one musical artist per episode that I've had the pleasure of either performing, recording, or work with in my career. Plus, I'll be interviewing artists I've always wanted to speak with. We'll discover how each artist developed their chops, listen to their stories, and much more. This is Got Chops. My special guest artist for today is a Grammy-nominated marimba and percussion artist who is a top prize winner of numerous music competitions and has appeared as a soloist with orchestras and in recitals throughout North America, Europe, and Asia. That's him playing the marimba behind me on the Etude Opus 11 No. 4 by Claire Omar Musser. My guest is also a sought-after private instructor and clinician who presents masterclasses at conservatories and colleges, and his teaching credentials include faculty positions at the esteemed Juilliard Pre-College and the percussion department at New Jersey City University. In addition, my guest is a Yamaha marimba and vibes artist and wrote the book Opinions on the Marimba, about interviews he conducted with some of the leading marimba artist teachers from the 20th century, available at Heartland Marimba Publications. This marimbist, aka marimba player, certainly got chops. Please welcome Greg Giannascoli. Good morning, Greg. This is Scott from Got Chops. How are you?
I'm good, Scott. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much. For my listeners at home, on the phone calling from Piscataway, New Jersey, is my special guest artist for today. This is a marimba player. The other traditional term is marimbist, and this is also one of my friends, Greg Giannascoli. He's a phenomenal artist. He is a very in-demand marimba player and marimba specialist that gives private lessons and professor at some prestigious music colleges and conservatories around the area. We'll talk about that later. We've been playing together for many, many years. We'll often find ourselves on the same gigs for theaters, for pit orchestras, for concert band, symphonic band, orchestras, small ensembles. We're in a great ensemble called the Hotel Excelsior Orchestra. Greg, thank you so much for granting me this time. I'm looking so forward to introducing you to my audience.
Thank you, Scott. It's my pleasure. It's nice to be here.
Oh, thank you. So, Greg, as a Grammy-nominated marimba and percussion artist and teacher, what does a music slang got chops mean to you?
Well, you know, when I saw the name of your podcast, it got me thinking of my undergraduate teacher, because he used to use that term all the time. And to him, and then to me now, it really means, in my field, a great set of hands, somebody that's fast and fluid at all volume levels, not just loud, but you should also be allowed, you know, able to play loudly for an extended period of time. And it should always sound easy and look easy and relaxed. You can play great fast runs, but aside from that, I also think that it means you should have beautiful long tones and really control over your hands, where you can play long tones and speed up your roll, slow it down, and taper it at the end. You know, what I tell my students a lot of times is that when you're finishing a long tone on the xylophone or marimba, you should be able to taper your sound away just like the best clarinet or trombone player would do. And for us in the field, there's two things that came to mind besides the typical person with chops. We might think of Buddy Rich, but it's amazing. People don't realize if you're playing timpani in an orchestra with an opera and there's a big Wagnerian type crescendo, the timpani player has to play a loud, beautiful role for a long time in some of that repertoire. And that's not easy. It's something that has to be worked on. And then personally, for me, when I listen to the old xylophone players from the 1920s, just about 100 years ago now, they had fast hands. They could play fast stuff, but they also had such a nice touch, and they made the rolls sound like it wasn't even a percussion instrument. It had such a haunting, beautiful sound to it. If you go on YouTube, you can find recordings of George Hamilton Green and another guy named Teddy Brown, who were both fantastic players from just about 100 years ago. And so I guess that's what it means to have chops to me.
That's a great answer. Thank you. So let me ask you, because I know that you're a Grammy-nominated artist, what were the works that you were nominated for a Grammy?
Okay, it was a recording of the last great American songbook by George Crumb. And it's a modern work, but it's so beautiful. It's for a voice and four percussion, piano. And it's just what a great piece of music. George Crumb wrote these songbooks with traditional folk songs and put them to his scoring. And they're just, it's fantastic. The whole process was awesome. And we got a wonderful recording. And I really thought we'd win that year, but we didn't. So, but it was nice to be nominated.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, that puts you on another level of performers, and people recognize that and they go, wow, who's this guy, Greg Gianoscoli? Let's listen to him. And the doors are going to open up a lot easier and a lot quicker because of things of that nature. So bravo to you.
Thanks. You know, in that, I played a lot of vibes in that recording and a lot of licks, and it was hard. But the last thing I had ready for that recording, I had to do a thumb roll like you would do on a tambourine on a bass drum head for 8 seconds. And I had to get it right 4 times in a row in the studio, because you would play it once and then something would happen. Then you'd play it again. And that took some practicing to get that thumb roll on the bass drum head to sound just right.
Technique is everything. Tone, technique, and if you have that, you do justice to the music. So I'm really happy to hear that you're saying that, especially to my young listeners that are thinking of majoring in music.
Yeah, well, I think technique is very important. I think it makes you able to move around your instrument and control your tone. And you know, the other thing I really think people don't realize, good technique helps you to avoid injury when you're playing. And in my field as a percussionist, we're very careful about that. With my students, I have a lot of rules about, you know, if you practice 20 minutes, take 5 minutes off with no other repeated motion. You know, don't go text or anything or sit on the computer. Rest your hands and stretch often. So good technique, it will make you have the facility to move around your instrument and get a good tone, but it'll also keep you injury free.
I believe in the same things when I'm teaching my students the importance of posture and sitting in a chair correctly, or you could just mess everything up.
That's right. I try not to hunch over, you know, when I'm playing. I think that's not good for you. And then you get a little sound anyway, if you're hunched over too much.
So I know you live in Piscataway. Is that where you were born and grew up?
No. My family's all from South Jersey. So I was born in a hospital in Philadelphia because my family never trusted the hospitals in South Jersey. And so I was born in Philadelphia and born and raised, in Vineland, which is Cumberland County.
Speaking of the marimba, was that your first instrument? And if it was, what was the attraction to playing a mallet instrument?
I actually started on drum set. We had a lot of relatives in the family that were all musicians. My grandfather was a drummer for Benny Goodman. And actually, when Gene Krupa got arrested and put in jail, my grandfather won the audition to take his place.
Really?
And yeah. And you know, they told him he had to be able to read music. And on the audition, they put the music up, but he just knew all the songs. He didn't read music. Most jazz drummers didn't read music.
That's
but
right.
He knew he knew the song, so they thought that he read it. So they took him. And he's got great time. I used to go listen to him play when he was alive. And so my grandfather, his son played with Captain and Tennille and the Hudson Brothers.
Oh, man.
And my grandfather's brother was, he played all different horns. And, you know, I have a picture of him with so many brass instruments around him that he played and really could play. It wasn't just that they were sitting there. And you can't find people that double that many things on brass anymore. So he played a lot of relatives. And my grandfather put a drum set in my playroom when I was about three, I guess. And so I always played drums. And as I got older, I discovered other percussion instruments and started to play more and more. And by the time I was in college, I was playing percussion. And it's funny, it's kind of a not a great way to find that you want to be a percussionist, but I was a rock drummer and I saw Carl Palmer play, and he played some marimba, some timpani, of course, drum set. And I said, well, if he's doing all that, I better learn how to do it more, you know, to get better at it. So I went to college for percussion because I thought I would be a rock star someday, but also still playing some percussion. And it didn't work out that way. It's what I'm doing. I couldn't be happier so with where I am.
Wow, that's fascinating. I love that story. So let me ask you, what was the pivotal moment in your life when you knew you were going to devote yourself to the study of marimba? And what was the inspiration to play classical music?
I had gotten to a point where I was falling in love with the sound of the marimba and fascinated with the techniques of formalance. And my junior year in college, I won a couple of competitions playing marimba. And then I got an internship with the Haddonfield Symphony to be a section percussionist. I was already playing there, but they gave me an award. And I said, you know, I'm going to stick with the classical stuff. I'm really going to focus on the marimba. Because at the time, I had set up lessons with a rock drummer to also start going to New York and taking drum lessons. But I said, I called him and I said, you know, I think I'm not going to do this because something else is calling my name to do it. So I went to a marimba camp that summer after my junior year and studied all summer with Lee Howard Stevens, a marimba player. And then I kept going and studying with great players all over. I had regular teachers in college, and the good thing about them is they were confident enough. They weren't self-conscious, so they didn't mind me going to study with other people. They would push me to do it. And I would take a little tour, I would call it, during Christmas break. I would go play for a guy in New York. I'd go play for a guy in Ithaca, and I'd go play for another guy in New Jersey and, you know, take all these ideas and things that they gave me to practice and kind of mix it all together in a pot. And when you take a little from each teacher that way, I think you sort of start to develop, you know, your own ideas and, you know, find out what works for you.
What was it like when you were younger? I mean, how many hours did you practice?
Well, in college, I still practice a lot now, at least 3 hours a day, which I'm very fortunate that I can arrange my schedule to have practice time. Some days more if I have a lot coming up. But in college, I was one of those guys that would roll out of bed and have a cup of coffee in his hand and go right to the practice room. Regrettably, sometimes I would walk right by my theory class and go right to the practice room. I'd wave to the teacher on the way by. So, and I've always been one of those people that's in the practice room all the time. I loved it. And we have a little place in Pennsylvania on a lake I go to that we got. And there's a marimba there, you know, and I practice when I'm at my vacation place because it's important to me. I feel empty without it, kind of. So,
is that one of the amenities by the lake that they supply all the places that you're staying at, marimbas? I don't know about that.
Yeah, They supply lots of things. No piccolos, though. No piccolos allowed.
I can't go there. Let's talk about where you attended music school during your college years and what degrees that you hold.
Okay. I went to Glassboro State College. It was the closest school to my house in South Jersey. And I didn't know much back then, but I stumbled on an excellent teacher. His name was Dean Witten, and he studied at Eastman. He's one of those many amazing players that comes out of Eastman. It's well-rounded on all the instruments, can sight read, has a great ear, everything. You know, one of those kind of players that just plays everything. And then he did his graduate work with a man named Jim Dotson in Texas, who's one of the great American marimba players, you know, one of the best of all time, who died way too young. So Dean had an excellent handle on marimba. And so I stumbled on an amazing teacher. And he was hard on me, which was good, because I needed somebody that pushed me at the early stages, because I was still figuring out what I wanted to do. And so he was a great teacher for me. And then for graduate school, I went to Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. And they offered me a great scholarship. And so I took it. And I had a great teacher there too, another Eastman graduate. He was principal percussionist with the Richmond Symphony. His name was Donald Bick. And, you know, he won a job with a military band when he was drafted. So if he didn't win that job, he would have been in Vietnam in the sticks.
Wow.
And so that's a lot of pressure to win an audition, and he won. And he also was doing theater work, all the touring Broadway shows that would come through Richmond. He played the Contemporary Chamber Ensemble, and he was slowing down when I got there a little bit. So by the time I was there and settled in, he had handed to me the Contemporary Chamber Group, the Broadway shows, and I was subbing in the symphony often. So the amount of experience I got as a graduate student in Richmond was incredible. It was something I wouldn't have been able to find anywhere else. It was just all the stars lined up to get me that. And he was not a marimba player, but he was an excellent musician. He would sit there with the score and like breathe and conduct and work on phrasing with me, which was what I needed at that time, because I already had a really good set of hands and I was playing super hard repertoire, but I needed somebody that would work on phrasing and put a leash on me, you know, with my tempos and my tone. I think I played too bright when I got there, and he straightened out some of that. Oh, I had one more, and I was freelancing in Richmond. You know, I was doing well down there, but I wanted to do some things. I wanted to record my first album and do some big time competitions. So I searched out where I could go and really get an artist diploma in marimba. And I found a teacher that taught a couple places named William Mersch, who is one of the preeminent marimba players of the 20th century and now 21st century. And so I ended up going to Rutgers. They gave me a great scholarship situation. And I studied with Bill while I was there, and I switched over to a doctorate while I was there, which I thought, if you're going to school for free, you really should get the DMA, you know, just in case. So I did. And I had a regular weekly coaching with him to get ready to record and compete. And we covered so much repertoire. He pushed me so hard, not just in the typical solo music that a college student would do, but we covered all this chamber music, a lot of the concertos for marimba. So that was like, if I hadn't have done that, I wouldn't be where I am today, if I didn't go for that last step.
One thing comes to mind. Nowhere do I ever see Dr. Gianna Scoli. You're not the typical person that goes all the way up to the highest degree. You don't flaunt that, because you're a true artist. You know, you care about your music and your art and your practicing. Most people I've found, this is not everyone, that go all the way up to becoming, you know, doctor, whoever, they're more academic. You are both academic and you're a great artist.
Thanks. Here's what I think when I advertise myself as a, you know, my bio and my stuff for recitals and other appearances. I think it's more like about the playing and the competitions that they, you know, when you get up on stage in front of an audience, I think that's what they're more concerned with, is that you're, you know, you're a real performer. And, you know, when I go back and I look at old programs of Horowitz or Rubinstein and, you know, and even newer players, it talks about, you know, where they played, where they did their debut recital, things like that. So I don't know, I kind of stole some of the ideas for what I think I should put in my publicity from other things I guess I read. And that doctorate, I got it, and it was nice. And I did some research, and I know how to go look for wrong notes and scores, I guess. Now I'm being cynical. but to me, I fell in love with music, and as a performer, that's paramount. It's just, I like expression and tone and repertoire. You know, it's just, to me, that's what's important. And I just thought, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to go off for a second about the 1990s when I was in college and some of these academics, because I think some of them ruined music. If you go back and you look at the violin recital that Heifetz would do, there'd be big repertoire, but then at the end, there'd be showpieces. There'd be familiar music. You know, Heifetz was a friend of Gershwin's, and he used to love to play Gershwin's music. You go to a recital now, it's like you're sitting in an academic class, because all they play is Brahms, and they ran the audience off, really, because they don't play that kind of music anymore, that flashy. You know, Horowitz used to play Stars and Stripes and the Carmen variations. It's a different ballgame today with repertoire. I think there's a little too much academia mixed in with the artistry.
My listeners might not know that a marimba player is also known as a marimbist. What do you prefer?
I just have always said marimba player, but I have to stop for a second when I write, because then I usually end up writing marimbist, because I think marimba player sounds slang sometimes, but usually I just say marimba player.
You're also a Yamaha marimba and vibes artist. How did you come about getting that? And what do you like about the Yamaha line of mallet instruments?
Okay. In 96, when I was at Rutgers, my teacher was a Yamaha artist. And he said, because I had a low A marimba back then, that's all I had. And then instruments were then going down past that to a C. So instead of the A on the bottom of the bass clef, most instruments being made were then going down further to the C, which is two lines below the bass staff. And so he said, you know, you're playing repertoire and you're playing on the school instrument, the five octave. You need your own five octave. And Yamaha has an instrument coming to New York. It's going to be at Carnegie Hall for 2 days for a festival. Back then, it was the George Solti Festival. And he said, if you want it, they're going to sell it to you for $6,000 after it's been used at the festival for 2 days. And I said, I'm getting it. And the bars are heavy on the Yamaha. It's the Yamaha 6000. They make a couple models, but it's known to us marimba players as the white one. It's the Keiko Abe model. She's a great marimba player from Japan that helped to develop the instrument. And I'm going to tell you, the bars are big. They're full sounding. They'll fill a huge concert hall. And my favorite thing about it is that when I play at the top, it has a brilliance to it. I'm not going to say brightness, because that almost makes it sound bad, but it's just such a clear, focused, brilliant tone at the top. There's clarity. Some marimbas, and I'm not going to badmouth any company besides, you know, the one I use. It's just that they don't have this sense of clarity throughout all the octaves, especially at the top. It's a little vague sounding sometimes. And if you solo with an orchestra, in reality, I think it's the only instrument, when the orchestra is really blowing, it's the only instrument that can be heard with clear pitch and tone.
When I perform with Greg, he is definitely playing Yamaha. And being a person that has endorsed other products, you know, sax, flute, and clarinet world, and Greg, you know this also, there are some people that just take on an endorsement deal because they just want to get their name out there. But in reality, we hear through the grapevine, they're really not playing that. They're playing what they've always played.
I know. Well, you know, I got with Yamaha in 96. When I bought the instrument, they signed me right away. And then I've been with them since 1996, and they've treated me beautifully. They're great people to work with. And I wouldn't sacrifice my integrity to play on something, to say, you know, to do that. I've been using Yamaha marimbas since then. I've been playing on Sabian cymbals since about 98. Now, I will say, I've been with several stick companies, and I'm never happy. So I'm liberated for the past like 8 years or 10 years. I've stopped using a certain company's mallet, and it's wonderful because I can use whatever I want. I make all my own mallets for some repertoire, and use some stock mallets for certain things, or just change them a little. And that's a nice thing.
You have performed as a soloist with various international orchestras and in recitals, and have also premiered over 20 new works for the marimba, including a piece entitled Phoenix for Marimba and Strings. Name some of the top awards you have won as a marimba artist, and what doors opened for you as a result of these winnings.
Okay, I'm going to go back a ways, because in undergrad school, I won a couple of competitions that really got me on the road and said, you know what they did in the early stages, those competitions? They made me think, you know, I think you can do this. This is possible. So they were very important, even though they were smaller. They did a lot of good for me. My first concerto competition, I won a competition at Rowan, which was back then was Glassboro State College. It gave me a free year of school, which was wonderful. And then in grad school, I started winning the National Music Teachers Association had a contest back then, and various concerto competitions. And then by the time I got to Rutgers, I started entering bigger competitions, and I won one in Toronto, Canada, for all instruments and voice. There were 7 finalists that were invited to the finals, and I won. And it was like, I think it was about $12,000 and 3 years of three years of concert appearances, which was a big deal. And you know, back then they put me with management after the 3 years. And I don't think the management knew what to do with me, because I was playing marimba, and I was playing the wrong music to have management. I was playing modern music, original music written for the marimba. And nobody wants to listen to that. When I go to colleges and play before a master class, I'll usually play like 30 minutes or 45 minutes. And I'll play that modern, you know, classic marimba repertoire that college kids are all playing. And it's great music. It's great contemporary music. But when I go play for the general public, contrary to some of my teachers' opinions, I'm not there to play that kind of music. Some of my teachers think I should not do transcriptions because it invalidates my instrument. And what I say is, if I was playing modern music, I'd be sitting home and I wouldn't be playing recitals for the general public. And I do well with that. And what I play in the general public recitals is completely different. It's Gershwin, it's Kreisler, it's Leonard Bernstein, you know, fantasies on Carmen, things like that, that the public says it sounds familiar, and they want to listen to it. It kind of draws them in. So once I figured that out, I started to play a lot more, and I won an audition for what's considered now, I think they call themselves Live on Stage, and they book most of the community concert series throughout the country, which is what Columbia used to do. And I know Horowitz used to complain because he was with Columbia, and they used to make him go play in Iowa or somewhere like that. And he used to hate playing places like that. But, you know, that community concert series had, you know, 300 or 400 different series throughout the country at one time that you had to go and play, and Columbia put them there. So I'm glad to go. There's not many of them close to New York because there's entertainment here already. But when you get out into the country, people are starving for entertainment. And, you know, I would play to sometimes packed houses. And sometimes in a small town, that's 125 people. But in a big town, it could be, you know, 1,500 or, you know, 1,800 people in a concert hall to see a marimba, for God's sakes. I mean, nobody goes to see a marimba. So, and believe me, if I had played modern music for those people, I think they would have hated me. But on stage with a piano, doing Rhapsody in Blue or something like that, they just love it.
I know this firsthand because the couple of different ensembles that we play in, you're always featured on the Rhapsody in Blue in the summer, and it's phenomenal. And the people, I don't care if it's a small crowd or a big crowd, they absolutely go nuts. And they're like, wow, that's fascinating. What is that called? Where can I find that? You know, where can I hear works about that? So in addition, as a faculty member at Juilliard Pre-College and the percussion department at New Jersey City University, you also give master classes and clinics, and you're an in-demand private instructor. In addition, you're an advocate for teaching proper practice habits, as you mentioned before, to your students, stressing the importance of warm-up concerts, programming the right music for the right audience, as you just mentioned, and the awareness of health and avoiding injury. So if you could talk about that a little bit.
I could. What I do really with my students and myself, because everything that they do, I've already done because I want to make sure it works. That to me is very important. If I start experimenting with some arpeggio exercises and that relate to certain repertoire, or if I find something like an octave etude that might relate to the xylophone excerpt that's in Schumann, the Third Symphony, I've practiced it before I give it to a student. I just don't go on hearsay or other people's opinions. I want to make sure it works. Now, with regard to my students, I'm very big on fundamentals, because if we don't build from the bottom up, they're going to have things lacking, and they're going to maybe have an injury. We want to strengthen the hands as much as possible from the early stages. So it's big on fundamentals, lots of scales and arpeggios. And I'm going to say right from the beginning, if a student does a scale exercise, it as they go up, we crescendo a little. As they go down, we diminuendo. And that's necessary so that they start right from the beginning to think of shaping and phrasing right away. And we start working on long tones right away as well. There's exercises I do for the hands. For the non-percussionists out there, a long tone on xylophone or marimba is called a roll, and it's a single stroke back and forth, right, left, right, left, right, left. The idea is you want to make it sound like a long sound instead of 16th notes. So there's a certain way we hold the sticks a little loose and we relax, and we make it fast enough that it shimmers but doesn't sound like a rhythm. So we work on that quite a bit. We also work on some things out of technique books. There's a great xylophone player. He's one of those early ones from the 1920s. And his name was George Hamilton Green. And he wrote a book called Instruction Course for Xylophone. I'm looking at lesson one on my music stand right now from a student that was in here yesterday. And in the old days, when he first wrote this, you would send money in, and every week you would get a lesson, a 3-page lesson in the mail, and you would practice it for a week, and then the next lesson would come.
Wow.
So that was kind of cool. And then somebody compiled them into a book. It was almost a forgotten about set of exercises. And then it was put into a book when I was in college, and it was like an epiphany to everybody that this is what we need to practice. And I guarantee, and what I tell my students is, almost half sarcastically, but half seriously, if you come in playing your George Hamilton Green exercises every week, like Paganini, you're going to be just fine. So, and if they do, they are just fine, because it increases your accuracy, your speed, your tone gets better, all of it. So, and it's all scales and arpeggios. And it was written during the ragtime era. So the third page of each exercise builds up. It's based on ragtime rhythms and intervals. You know, it's almost as if you're accompanying a soloist playing chords with a ragtime feel underneath. And that'll develop some chops, I'll tell you that. It's a great book for that. So it's lots of technique. Every week, students also are assigned a page of sight reading exercises. And I can't be there every day with them at their house sight reading. So the next best thing I have figured out is I assign one page and they have to read the page top to bottom. It's got different keys, different exercises, different tempos, but I want them top to bottom without stopping. And really, we start easy. And I always, with my students, err on the side of starting a little too easy, because I'm going to tell you, as a teacher, one of my jobs is to convince them that they can do this. And if I start throwing sight reading stuff in front of a student that is impossible, that's not doing the kid any good. You know what I'm doing then? I'm convincing them they can't do it, which is the wrong way to teach. I want to build them up as much as possible. And that doesn't just mean their hands. It means their mental ability, their confidence, the fact that they know they can do something. And they're almost fearless by the time I'm done with them. So we do a lot of sight reading. Every week they're assigned it's one page of its exercises. We cover all the keys, everything. I will say quickly, I incorporate into the sight reading some easy double stops. That means two notes at the same time with us on the xylophone or marimba, and some 6/8, 3/8, 5/8. Because I notice in auditions, when I listen to students, they do fine when they're reading 4/4, 16th notes. But some students panic when they have to do a couple double stops here and there, or 6/8 time, because they haven't done enough of it. It's just lack of experience. So I make sure they have enough experience in that. Now, I know some teachers that think sight reading is just the most important thing in the whole world. It's good. I mean, I use it a lot on jobs, but I think memorization is equally important. In the field I'm in, nobody plays a recital with music, except maybe I think it's acceptable on the harpsichord for some reason. That's a tradition. But as a classical soloist, I would never use music. I just don't do it. And I think it's an acquired skill like anything else. And I think students that can play from memory, it's something that they should be able to do. Now, I don't make them memorize timpani or snare drum solos, but any mallet solo that you would play on stage as a, you know, as a classical performer, I think should be memorized. That's a strong opinion I have. And when I play for presenters, they say, thank goodness you memorized, because lately we've been getting a couple soloists in that use music and we don't like that.
Let's tie this in. Let's take the Rhapsody in Blue. That's a very long piece, and you have a magnificent arrangement of that you perform. How long did it take you to memorize all those sections?
I'm going to tell you what I did with that piece, and it's what I'm doing right now with another arrangement of Porgy and Bess that I'm learning to start playing this summer. Usually, if I know I want to play something, I get the music. I start hammering through it, and I don't try and memorize it. The first step for me with learning a big work is to bang out licks over and over and over. I do them up to tempo a few times to make sure my sticking pattern works when I really have to play it. But then I slow it down. So mentally, visually, it's just pounded into me. And I go over a lick a whole bunch of times with a metronome on a moderate tempo, and then I go to the next lick, and I'll do that for about 2 weeks. And then the next step, when I go back to memorize the piece, it's really already memorized. So, and I find for me, that's the best way to work on something. Now, if I'm under pressure, I know I did a competition one time where all the competitors received a piece that was commissioned for the competition 2 weeks before the competition. And it was a pretty hard contemporary piece of music, and I memorized it in a week. And then I had some warm-up recitals before the competition of all the repertoire, and I played it. And, you know, I can memorize fast when I have to, but I prefer the method I use where I just bang things out. Because really, the memory's not a problem. It's getting to the right pitches at fast tempos with a good tone that I start working on right away. And I'm going to tell you something about that Rhapsody in Blue. Because for 10 years I played with Peter Nero in the Philly Pops, and Peter taught me a lot about programming. You know, he just taught me so much. I sat back and I listened to him play, a real virtuoso piano player, and also had a good rapport talking to the audience. I picked up a lot from him on that. He used to tell a few jokes. He'd warm up the audience, you know, in more ways than one, not just with his playing, but with his speech, his humor. And I really thought so highly of Peter that I stole some things from him, including his repertoire and some of his jokes when he was on stage. So you have to be able to keep the audience warmed up to you in more ways than one. Listening to that guy play Rhapsody in Blue, it's one of the best interpretations I've ever heard. He was a real Gershwin player.
Could you please explain your 10,000 hour rule?
Oh, well, okay. Um, I since I teach a lot and I teach kids that are at a very high level, you know, kids that get into Curtis and Juilliard, Manhattan School, we discuss the mental aspect and how long it's going to take you to get where you have to go. You know, it's and I read a couple things about, you know, how the brain works and what you have to be doing. I'm big on reading. And I read a book by Jeff Colvin, who's a he writes for, I got the book right here. He writes for Fortune magazine. And the book he wrote is called Talent is Overrated, which I think is a better book than The Outliers. That's another book that talks about the same thing. And if you go back and look at these guys, they were not necessarily born composing symphonies like Mozart. They worked at it a little bit in the early stages. Tiger Woods practiced how to play golf. It just didn't come completely naturally. And the Beatles didn't sound that great when they started. They had been playing clubs for that magic number, which seems to work for most, is the 10,000 hours. And that's not just practicing for us musicians. That's actually being out playing in front of people under pressure. And I think when I went back and I read those articles and the research that was done that the articles are based on at some universities, it really is true. I did the math and I said, well, I'm just about there and I'm finally able to halfway play my instrument and you know, get in front of audiences and do a good job. So you have to just repeat. You know, Ben Franklin used to have to practice. He would sit down and copy people's writings. And that's how he learned how to use words so well. He was obviously intelligent and obviously gifted at it, but those put a higher level of finishing touches on what he became. You know, the same, like I said, with Mozart, I think his father used to make him sit and copy Christian Bach's music, like just write it down to learn orchestration and, you know, how the chords worked for Christian Bach. And there's a lot of stories like that about how people worked for the just about a 10,000 hour period before they started to really get good. And I use this too to convince my students, because here's what happens in college to a lot of us. We get a piece of music 3 weeks before our final exam, which they call a jury. And then you have to play it. And you play it one time at the jury and it goes okay, not that great. And then you put it away and you might start to think, gee, I really don't think I can do this. Well, if you look, it takes a long time to develop a real talent. It really takes a long time. And to develop a piece of repertoire, it takes a long time. If you go listen to the best Chopin recordings, even live ones with Arthur Rubinstein, and you say, well, how can he play these pieces so well and nobody else can? And it's because he's been playing them since he was a little kid. And then he performed it in a concert when he was 65 years old. So no wonder he plays it so well. You know, of course, he's probably one of the most talented musicians of the 20th century. But on top of that, he's been playing that piece of music for, you know, what, 60 years? So no wonder it sounds so good and so fluid and so natural. You know, it just drips off the fingers when he plays it, and other people don't. On a smaller scale, because it's not as they haven't lived as long. But when I have students come and they say, well, I want to audition for these places and I need to learn some new music for the auditions. And I say, oh, no, you don't. I said, you've been playing repertoire, because I assign a lot of repertoire to my students over the years. I said, you know, you're playing repertoire in a very important situation. We're going to go back and find the two marimba pieces that seem like they were written for you, that you had a great experience with, you played well, now you're more mature, you're gonna play it even better, because working up new music for an important audition is not a good idea compared to playing something that's, you know, I said to the kid, you wanna sound seasoned and like you've done this before. So, you know, we'll go back and find, because most colleges, when you audition, the marimba portion of your percussion audition is one piece for four mallets, and kind of a heavyweight piece they want for a good school. And then a piece for two mallets. because Two Mouths is just as hard as Four. It's just a whole different ball game, and it should never be something that's let go once you start playing Four Mallets. Now, that could be argued. I know that Dave Samuels used to play Four Mallets all the time. I don't know if I've ever seen Gary Burton hold just Two Mallets. Some players hold Four all the time. But for marimba, classical marimba, it's you really have to be able to do both equally well. So we find stuff that sounds like, you know, they sound like $1 million when they're playing it. And just one more analogy, I guess you'll call it. Or maybe we'll call it a malaprop because it's a Yogi Berra thing. Because I used to get worried about memorization because you're in front of people on stage, right? You don't want to forget. And Yogi Berra, they asked him, they said, what do you think about when you're up to bat? And he goes, I don't think about anything. He goes, I thought about that before. And when I go up, I just do it and don't even think about it. And when I read that, it was like this other world opened up to me. And I'm like, oh, I'm not worried. So I don't get worried anymore.
So Greg, talk about the new book you've written and recorded entitled The Opinions on Playing the Marimba. You interviewed many leading marimba players about what they learned from their teachers, what evolved along the way, and what they now teach their students, published by Heartland Marimba Festival Publications, along with the other works of yours as well.
Okay, so for 10 years, I taught at Juilliard Pre-College, and which that's like the best job because the kids are as into the marimba as, you know, as I am. So, and they played like fantastic. So I had a boy from China who really played great. He was 13, but he didn't know anything about the history of the instrument, anything about the people that came before him. So we talked and talked, and then I started thinking, you know, future generations are gonna need some ideas and some information about what people thought about how to practice, how to play, what's important about avoiding injury. It's just the whole gamut of things that are involved with marimba playing. So I put together a series of questions and sent them out to probably 50 people that are older generation marimba players that are still alive. And some of them are in their 90s. So, you know, they studied with the very first players, you know, so that I got information all the way back to the beginning of when the marimba and xylophone came to the West, which to me, that's so it's important information. I had one guy who I consider the best xylophone player in the world right now, Bob Becker. And he was a little reluctant at first. And I said, Bob, you know, I wish Franz Liszt just sat down and wrote everything that he thought we should be practicing and like a whole method book. Now, he did a lot for us through his repertoire, you know, the piano pieces. But we don't have a lot of the great players, you know, talking about what they learned, what's changed through their career and what they teach now. So the questions dealt with, just real quick here, their early years about getting started in music. And I thought that was important because some of the studies done with the most successful musicians in the world show that there was music in the house when they were little. So, and that's a majority of them. And I wanted to see if that was that way for us. And then what did their teacher show them? What exercises, what method books, what repertoire did they do when they were little? And then the same questions were asked about what they did in college. You know, what repertoire, what method books, what technique books, you know, all of it. Were there scale exercises, you know, memorization? And then that's for each degree program that the person did. And then there's things about the professional career. I wanted their opinions on health for the hands, on management, on recording. You know, if they want to talk about microphones, commissioning, did they do a debut recital in New York? Is that or Paris? Was that important to them or Tokyo? And then really, what are they teaching now? what's changed over their life that maybe they don't like that book, they like this book, or, you know, anything like that. Different ways they teach. And then there's an additional bunch of questions where they can talk about anything that they want, you know, that's important. And we, you know, there were questions about sight reading. There were questions about memorization and chamber music, concertos, and just everything. So it's pretty detailed. And about 27 people answered, including, you know, some people that were up there in years. So I did get back to the beginning. And I think it's a wealth of information about our instrument, its history, its pedagogy. So it's and just the biographies of all these artists. So each person got a chapter, and I took their answers and put it in paragraph form. And I really didn't change anything, except, you know, if there was misspelling or something, that I wanted this as much in their words as possible. And I asked for as many notational devices, some photographs, you know, there's pictures of people with their teachers. And it's just, but most importantly is the information that was gotten from each one. And I'm going to say there's some common threads that run through the book with importance, scales, arpeggios, fundamentals, things like that. But then there's some teachers that teach differently. And what I think it's important is every student we're going to have is different. So maybe it's good to have all these different opinions in here. And I have a second book. They contracted me to do a second one because they like this one. And I've already got a great lineup of people that have committed. It's just starting. So it'll probably take me about 2 or 3 years to finish that one. And in this one, there were a couple people that were the older generation, and I don't want to insult them by saying that. It's almost like I mean more of a in a venerated way. But they were busy or doing something, and I'm going to ask them again. It's been a hit. It's selling well, and it's really what it's all about is when we're all dead and gone, that next generations are going to have a window into and a place to find the opinions of older players, you know, that aren't with us anymore, you know, me included.
I think that's great. Bravo to you.
Thanks.
And I would love to see you do a TED talk about this. I think that would be interesting as hell.
Oh, they might not have me on the TED talk.
Just stick to the script.
Yep.
So, share with my listeners the other things that you do to make a living in the music business that include booking groups for park concerts and other performances through the Musicians Union. And for my young listeners, explain what a Musicians Union is all about and what are the benefits of becoming a member.
Okay, so let's see. Aside from playing marimba, which I'm so fortunate because I guess because of the competitions and things. Now, I'm not Itzhak Perlman playing the violin or Rachmaninoff playing the piano, so I don't get as many recitals as somebody like that. But as a legitimate classical marimba player playing real recitals for the general public on series, if I get 30 a year, I'm happy. So that's a good portion of concerts. And then, I will go around to colleges and spend a day or two teaching as a guest. And, you know, part of that Yamaha supports and part the college pays for, and I'll play a concert while I'm there. Sometimes I'll solo with the group, like some of the things I've written or some big pieces out there for marimba and percussion ensemble. And sometimes I'll just play a recital and for them of standard marimba repertoire written by, you know, the modern stuff. And there's some good stuff out there. You know, I just finished a video of a piece by John Sary called Night Rhapsody, a piece by Richard Rodney Bennett called After Syrinx 2, and a piece by David Maslanka. These are all heavyweight composers of the 20th century, that called Variations on Lost Love is Maslanka's piece. And that video is coming out pretty soon. I think you have two of the encores that I'm going to put on that video, or one of them anyway, by Musser that'll maybe be in this, this podcast. Mm-hmm. Now, aside from the marimba though, and I teach the marimba quite a bit too. I've been with the Princeton Symphony since 1994 as a regular, you know, section contracted player. Like, they can't get rid of me. Yes, they could get rid of me if they wanted, but so I've been with them a long time, and I love classical music, and I, you know, playing in a symphony is great. And every time I even think about, because it's been a long time I've been doing that, about retiring, we do some beautiful piece by Rachmaninoff, and I'm just like, ugh, I'm staying, you know, because I love that music. And my wife, who's a musician, says, you know, the solo music is just the tip of the iceberg, and there's so much more out there. And she's right. You know, as closed-minded or tunnel-visioned as I am about, I love the marimba, and that's, if I could only be doing that, there's so much great music out there to listen to and to perform. So I play in the Princeton Symphony. There's a couple other orchestras I play with a lot. I do theater work in the summertime at an outdoor theater. And the thing I love about it is I don't have to go off and do a music festival at some faraway place. We have a 13-year-old son, and I want to stay close to home. So I can go do a show at night, and I can practice marimba all day and hang out with my family, which is awesome. So the summer theater work is nice for that. And I do occasionally still back up an act, like a famous old singer or something, but I try not to do that too much anymore. I have an instrument rental business where I rent to some theaters and some like percussion equipment, timpani, xylophone, chimes, anything they need, drum sets. I rent to theaters and acts and just shows that are playing. So that keeps me pretty busy, and that's an easy job. I contract, which means I hire other musicians. Like an orchestra will come, or an organization will come and say, we need a 40-piece orchestra for this week in the year, and can you get the people? And, you know, of course I can. That's not my favorite job, because it's a lot of paperwork for payroll, and it's dependent on other people to show up on time. But I'll tell you what, going into it, I was worried about doing that, but I've been doing it a lot of years, and most people show up on time. They want to get hired again. You know, and the ones that don't, I don't hire again. So, you know, I can say it's I was raised a certain way to show up on time and be places that I say I'm going to be. And thank goodness I was, because to be in the music business, that's what you have to do.
The contracted jobs that you're talking about are through the musicians union. So if you can tie that in, you know, the benefits of being a union musician.
Well, I'll tell you, they go to bat for us to make sure we get paid a certain wage and that the place pays. I can give you an example. There was an opera company in New Jersey that didn't pay the musicians one time. And this is a union job, and the union went after them and made sure the musicians got paid. And we had a very friendly congressman, actually a state congressman. It's like in the assembly, not down in Washington, but in Trenton. And he was on the board of this orchestra, and he went back to the board and said, listen, you're paying these people, because he was, you know, and he was a Republican, but he was very union friendly. You know, they all got together, the union and the congressman, and said, you know, you're going to make sure these musicians are paid. So and that's good. And, you know, there's strength in numbers. I'm in a couple of organizations that if I was by myself, I'd be a voice in the wilderness. But if I have, you know, let's say 4 million people or 100,000 people, and we're all working together, and we get a letterhead, you know, that says we're the musicians union, then there's more clout there and people have to listen to you. So I guess that's a good thing.
Absolutely. So, Greg, if you could pick two different musical selections that you've recorded that you feel best represents what you do as a marimba player, that I could filter into this interview as you speak about them now.
Okay. Well, let's see. When I go out and play for the general public, let's put it with those. And, you know, I try and rotate pieces into my program, so I don't go nuts playing the same pieces all the time. But I will say that when I leave two pieces in particular off my program, I feel like I'm not giving the audience everything I should. And those would be Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin, which is what a fantastic piece of music. You know, it was commissioned by Paul Whiteman, who was a band leader and had a radio program back in Gershwin's time in the 20s. And Gershwin premiered it with Paul Whiteman in New York City. Gershwin was obviously at the piano, and it was a theater orchestra, like a smaller orchestra with some winds and strings. And, you know, when Gershwin had a big work like that premiered, it was an event in the music world. And Rachmaninoff came to the concert. Percy Grainger, who was a famous band composer, and John Philip Sousa was there. So right off the bat, this piece was getting good press and good attention. And since then, it's just like one of the most recognizable pieces of American culture when it comes to music. It's been on Broadway, it's been in movies, it's been in TV commercials. So audiences hear that. And again, I talked about warming up to the audience or getting them to warm up to you. And this piece definitely does that. So I really find it difficult not to keep programming this piece. And I haven't gotten sick of it yet. I love it.
And the second piece?
Well, the second piece is another one that I almost feel obligated. Usually toward the end of my recitals, I play a slow, beautiful solo by Bach. And, you know, it's something through the whole recital. They haven't heard that texture and that color yet. So it saves something. And after something slow like that, I just jump right in with Flight of the Bumblebee, which just, it floors them because they like it. And when I've sent video clips to presenters, they always insist, they say, you're definitely going to play that on our concert, right? And I always have to say yes, because they're the guys paying the bills, you know? So, and I love it. It's a great piece of music. Every classical soloist has played Flight of the Bumblebee.
So do you have any upcoming live performances or projects that you'd like to announce right now?
Well, I'm working on this. I'm finishing, really. I think I'm going in this week, and I'm just going to take all the major works and the etudes and stick them together into one longer video for a concert format. And I recorded the three major works for marimba plus two etudes. And I'm going to keep doing this. I have the bug to do it. This first one will be out in May of 2023. And then I'm slated to go back in the video studio and do, because it's a TV studio. And they said, we're starving for things to put on. So when I go in to do this, I'm going to do an all Gershwin program in October, right in the middle of when I'm playing it in recitals. I'm going to record, it's about an hour, maybe 45 minutes. Let's see what I'm doing. American in Paris, which is the Yasha Heifetz version. It's his arrangement. Fantastic. And then I'm doing a version of Porgy and Bess for violin and piano, and I'm playing the violin part on the marimba, the Rhapsody in Blue, and then Peter Nero's version of I Got Rhythm. And they said that's for mass distribution to the general public, which will be great because it'll be on TV stations all over the country. And then in a year, I'm doing the same idea, but with all Fritz Kreisler music, which will be very cool. And then somewhere along the line, I'll do another modern, because I want to make sure that the modern marimba repertoire that I really think highly of, I've recorded videos of that. I've done a lot of CDs in the past, but I think it's important in this modern time that students, professionals, anybody can see my hands and the whole thing. So I like the idea of the video now with it, so you can actually see the person play as well as hear it. And then
great.
Yeah, I got another book I'm working on of the second ones of this, Opinions on the Marimba. And I start doing solo recitals again in the summer. I'm just doing about five or six, and I'm trying out my music. And then I really start hitting the ground with, I think it's October, I start doing regular subscription series recitals again. And this year it's special. The first half of the recital is all Gershwin. Then there's intermission, and the second half is all Fritz Kreisler, either original pieces by him or pieces he's arranged for violin and piano. And I'll tell you that Fritz Kreisler, it's some of the best music. Do you know when he was 7 years old that he was the youngest person ever accepted to study at the Vienna Conservatory?
Wow.
Back in that's back in the 1800s, 1880s, I guess. He was that good. He studied composition with Bruckner. And then, of course, he studied the violin. And then he went to the Paris Conservatory and studied. And by the time he was 13, he came to America by himself and gave his New York debut recital in the U.S.
Wow, a great history lesson right there. Thank you. So where can my listeners find you on social media?
Well, I don't do much. I try and stay away from social media because it gets me in trouble. But I do keep an active YouTube page where I post like videos of, concerts and things like that. And during the Corona lockdown, I started to do these where I would play a piece and then take it apart as like almost a masterclass. And so I started doing more and more of that on YouTube. And that seems to be a good source. Occasionally I go on Facebook, but that's mostly like family pictures anymore and things like that.
Right.
But YouTube, and it's just my name, Greg Marimba, G-R-E-G, and then the word Marimba, is my YouTube site.
And can my listeners find and purchase your music online anywhere?
I think my CDs are at a big percussion outlet place called Steve Weiss Music. And if you go on Steve Weiss Music online, you can find it. It comes up right away on a search engine.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for granting me this time to interview you. You and I have been friends for many years. We have played in many different orchestras and concert bands and all different types of genres. You're a phenomenal player. You're a font of knowledge. You are passionate not only as a performer, but as a music educator on the mallets. And it's a pleasure knowing you and sitting alongside of you or standing alongside of you in any performance that we play. And I look forward to gigging with you again this summer.
Thank you, Scott. You're the greatest. I appreciate you asking me to do this. It's been a lot of fun. And to everybody out there, listen to this guy because I play with him and he's a great wind player and a nice guy, just a pro through and through as a performer.
Thank you. You're too kind. Have a great day and I will see you on the next bandstand.
Okay, Scott. You take care and thank you again.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for joining me on today's show. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and could hear why my guest got chops. You can follow my podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or Anchor.fm, and stay connected between episodes on Instagram at Gottschalk's Podcast. Join me on the next episode when we discover why my next guest got chops.